Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with CMO Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're happy to have join us Fouad El-Noor. He is based in London. He's a co-founder and CEO of ThinkSono. And prior to that, he was the entrepreneur with Entrepreneur First, and he created a medical startup. He has some great thoughts to share around leadership, and we're looking forward to today's conversation with Fouad. Well, I love to hear people's stories, and definitely take us back to kind of give us an overview. And if you want to go beyond your career earlier, that'd be great. Love to hear your story.
Sure. Where do we start? Well, we can start from, I mean, it's up to you, but we can start from how I got into this entrepreneurship journey. Sure. So I'm actually an electronic engineer. So that's my degree. I remember I said I'm a pseudo engineer even when we graduated. So I went to the University of Southampton to do electronic engineering. And but I always wanted to, I always like multidisciplinary things. So like any two fields that mix is very interesting to me. So in my case, I was always interested in medicine or biology with technology because they're so separate. And so putting them together, lots of interesting stuff comes out. So I always knew I wanted to do something in that space. And then back in 2016, I went to the Bay Area to work for a software company called SAP, some large IT company. And I sort of slowly got into entrepreneurship. You know, you can't help it when you're sure. In the Bay Area near San Francisco. I was actually in Palo Alto at the time. And I just thought, wow, like there's a lot of stuff happening. But I felt like at the time, at least, that not much was happening in biotechnology or medical technology. I just felt like there was so much focus on social media at the time and advertising and ad tech and stuff like that. And I just I know like dating apps was a big, I mean, still a big thing now, but it was also sort of coming up then. And I just thought, actually, I want to do something that as much money as you can make in all these other spaces, it doesn't drive me enough. So I wanted to do something that's multidisciplinary and that has a real impact. And so I decided there was some, you know, I'm actually a Norwegian randomly by nationality, so I couldn't stay in the US forever. So I had to go back after my internship, and I got the visa and everything to go back to the US, but was offered for a place at Entrepreneur First in London. And Entrepreneur First is a bit similar to Y Combinator. The main difference, I mean, there's lots of differences, but one of the main ones is that they don't invest in companies. They bring you in as an individual, like a quote talented individual or something. And you know, they're fairly selective. They only select like 100 people out of 1,000 applicants or something. And so when I got in there, I had to make a choice between staying in London and building something or going to the Bay Area and building something. And at the end, I decided, well, I don't want to wait like 3 or 4 years, you know, deal with all the legalities of doing something in the Bay Area. Instead, I just decided, you know what, I'll just start something here and then I can always go to the US later. So that's sort of how that happened. I joined Entrepreneur First, and at Entrepreneur First, I met my co-founder. That's sort of how the program works. You meet co-founders and try to start a company. And to skip a bunch of other details, that's sort of the inception of what I'm doing right now, which is detection of deep vein thrombosis, so blood clots in the leg, using AI and ultrasound. So we enable nurses to detect blood clots with ultrasound. And currently today, only like a radiologist or trained clinician can do it. But with our technology, a nurse can just use these devices, and using our software, they're able to perform the same scan that a radiologist does. And that has huge clinical implications. Sure. So we've been running for almost 7 years, so 6.5 years now.
That's great. Well, we're going to talk a little bit later on about AI and healthcare and just some of the things that are going on, but definitely it's a great story. So if you were able to spend back time and talk to a 22-year-old squad, what advice would you give them knowing what you know now?
So I wasn't that much older, actually. I was about 25 when I started. So sure. Sort of, I'm thinking, what advice would I give myself? I'm slightly younger than this.
Recent memory.
yeah. I'm not that old, although I'm sort of, you know, going towards in my 30s now. But the biggest advice I would give is that there's a misconception about career risk. That if you start something on your own, you're really not, in my opinion, it's not a serious risk when you're 22. At 22, that is when you're supposed to take risks in almost everything in your life. Nothing dangerous, but if at least in your career, that's the time when you want to do something different, chase whatever dream you have. It doesn't matter really what it is. It could be tech, it could be non-tech, and just go for it, because I think people far estimate the damage taking some sort of building something or starting something on your own. It's hard, but working in a company is also hard, you know, and you can still get fired and you might change careers later on. And so I think that there is a misconception of how much risk there is, especially when you're only 22 and you have less responsibilities. So my view is, if I could advise myself, even at 25, if I could start earlier my journey, I would have started even at 22.
So is any advice that you were given on early on in your career that you should have ignored?
I would say when I was at university, I went to Southampton University. It's an excellent university for engineering, but they really didn't have a huge amount of entrepreneurship push. The idea was, you know, you graduate and then you work for one of the big tech firms. Sure. And that was really like the path, and everything was optimized for that. And so I was a bit in a bubble where I thought, you know, if you're not working for one of the big tech firms, then you've sort of, everything else is a failed sort of way of doing things. And then I remember, in fact, Entrepreneur First sort of came up to me at that point and asked me if I wanted to join. So this is even before I went to the US. I was like, what? Why would you start? Why would you do this startup thing? Just work for one of the big companies. It's much more interesting. And I wasn't even a huge fan of business in general, because I was such an academic. I was like, businesses just want to make money and I want to do real science. And the irony of the entire thing is that we've done far more science, arguably, than any path that I could have done in academia. I mean, we've published papers that are, you know, arguably way more rigorous than most academic papers, even from a scientific perspective, not just like a business commercial perspective.
Sure. So You've helped build a company, and you're definitely involved as far as in hiring your first kind of leadership team and that. What are some things that you wish you would have known earlier about building a team and just some of those people decisions that that people need to make as founders?
I would question people's credentials a lot more, put less weight on that, because there was a period of time where we employed a lot. I mean, again, very smart people, like top-notch PhDs and stuff. Or even very, very good salespeople at the time, commercialization people or advisors, you know, having a lot of fairly experienced people in the team. But one of the downsides of increasing your team that way is that you think throwing people at a problem is going to fix it. Mm. And that is not the case at all. You have to be extremely crystal clear before you take anyone else on, doesn't matter what their pedigree is, that the problem is actually whatever. Usually people employ staff to solve a particular issue, so they have some sort of bottleneck, some sort of particular problem they're trying to solve, and really figuring out, adding another person, is that really the thing that's going to solve this problem? And is I think we should have been much more rigorous about that. I'm much more comfortable being a small team now than I was back then. And it is a bit of an ego. You want to go to your entrepreneur friends or whoever else is in the VC community to say, yeah, you know, I have 20 staff working for me and it feels good. And they, you know, if it's your first time, you've never had I don't like the word power, but you've never had an experience where you have enough money to literally employ someone. But the downside of all of this is that you have to manage them really well. And I take that extremely seriously. You have to make sure they have career progression. You have to make sure that they have enough interesting work to do. And finally, sometimes, unfortunately, you have to let them go. And that experience is so painful for them and for you that you have to be, I would have been much more critical about taking on more staff at the early stage before product market fit.
So the, you said, talking about as far as those hard decisions around people and letting them go. And I heard an executive who's done several startups say, if that doesn't bother you, there's something wrong with you if you let somebody go. But talk about, you know, that whole process. You know, what lessons have you learned around that as far as you evaluate people and roles?
So we've employed people and we've let people go a bunch of times. And I'll take the first point, which is evaluating roles. What we do now is we are much more careful about making it very clear to whomever we're going to have join the team how ambiguous and difficult the role is going to be at the early stage. It's usually not very well defined because people's expectations, if they haven't worked in startups before, some people have. And so that sort of, they accept the ambiguity. But if you're employing people who've never worked in a startup before, that would be almost my first question to them. And especially which stage of a startup. At the earliest stages, you have to have people that are completely okay with doing something that is outside of their, let's say, whatever it is that you offered them at the start. So let's say you want an engineer to join your team. That engineer might end up doing management. They might end up going on customer calls. They might also end up doing, in our case, regulatory writing. So there's a lot of other things. There are many more hats that they have to wear as an early stage employee than they would otherwise, you know, in a much larger company where they have a specialized skill set. And so I would make that very clear to whomever we take on at the start. And I think almost any startup should really think carefully about that.
We have a number of new CEOs or people that are thinking about kind of moving into that next, either starting a company. What advice would you give around, you know, I think the thing that most CEOs that are, you know, doing a startup don't realize how much time they have to spend on the fundraising side of things, of doing the pitches for either VC money or private equity later on. Talk about just some of the things that you learned around that, around fundraising and the importance of just kind of your message.
So we've been fundraising for a long time. And I mean, that's like any startup, everyone, you're always fundraising as a CEO, pretty much at almost every single level, even post IPO, then you're talking to analysts. So the first thing I would say, you have to accept that fact. It's a lot of CEOs are very resistant to this basic fact. You have to just absorb that as part of your job. It feels like a waste of time because you're like, oh, well, I could be running my business better. I could be doing sales. I could be managing. But at the end of the day, and I got this advice from my own investors when I used to complain about it. So this comes from my very deep scars that I've had, where I remember one of my investors said, you know, like, as tough as it is literally your job. Like, it is what you signed up to do. This is what being a CEO is like. It's not glamorous. And that sort of, you know, I took that home with me and I was like, you know what? You're right. I shouldn't complain about it as much as I do. Although it is really tough. And sometimes when you're speaking to other entrepreneurs, you do want to have this cathartic experience of just talking about it because it just makes you feel better. The advice I would give when it comes to fundraising is accept the fact that it's going to be very tough. Also be selective with your own psychological well-being, that you will get a lot of no's. So go out and be ready to face psychologically the number of no's you're about to get from very smart people, which is much harder than usual. But also remember that although the VCs are saying no, or many of them will say no, they are your customers in the sense that you need them to fundraise for your company, but they are not your, say, prime prime customer. Your prime customer is the most important how shall I say, North Star that you base your entire company on. So I am much more acutely aware of what my customers say, their feedback, versus some random investor that I spoke to and their opinion. Because you don't know what background they have. And even if they're in your particular space, they haven't spoken to your customers. So you have to take every feedback with a pinch of salt and put different weights on different feedback, and also protect yourself mentally from the barrage of no's you're about to get, and be ready for that in whatever you have to do to get ready for it. Maybe you wait for a month extra, maybe you take a break for a week and just recuperate. So that's really important. And also, I would say one of the most sort of underrated things is talk to other entrepreneurs, because other entrepreneurs can tell you, yes, this is normal, don't worry about it, or can give you some critical feedback.
Yeah, great advice. So what are you excited most about? I know you're in the space of using AI and just all the things that, I think there are a lot of people that are fearful of AI right now, just kind of thinking, okay, is it going to replace all the jobs? But give us a little perspective as far as what you're seeing that's exciting in the area of, you know, healthcare medicine using AI.
Yeah, so I think the thing that's scary about AI, weirdly enough, I'm less worried about AI in medicine than outside. And the reason is medicine is so hardcore regulated already. And to be fair to the FDA and the notified bodies in Europe and regulators, they've kept an eye on this very carefully for now a sort of somewhat longish amount of time. I mean, the regulations are still being updated. But in the medical space, mitigating and managing risk is something that we do constantly. So if you think about drug development or something, there are many unknowns there. And so we know how to do that. AI is just another thing that they have to sort of be careful about regulating, and the regulations are very carefully scrutinized. The problem, I think, will come outside of medicine, where if you think about AI, say, creating deep fakes, or, you know, creating the fake voices and videos of public figures or something. To me, that's actually trickier because it's much less regulated. It's much harder to justify ethically. You don't know about misinformation versus who defines what misinformation is, for example. So I think it's a much more difficult problem. But I think it's obviously a very powerful technology that we can use to provide a huge amount of value in the future. I just think people developing AI technologies just have to be very careful about how they do it. And obviously medicine, this is sort of well recognized. The biggest thing I will say, not to talk out of line about AI outside of medicine, but within medicine, prospective clinical trials are really important. Like this, I think the venture capital community have not realized the value of prospective, blinded, ideally randomized if you can, clinical trials. That's what, at least that's my view of how we run things at my company, which is everything is always thoroughly tested with actual patients, you know, and constant communication with regulators. And I think the big gap I'm seeing are from the VC community doesn't quite recognize that as much. About what you actually have to do to make sure the AI within a medical context is very safe. To give you one small example, some people already are discussing about using ChatGPT, for example, and immediately, you know, red flags all around. It's like the people usually suggesting this have no idea what this all means, you know, like how many regulations are being broken immediately, what you have to really, you know, unintended consequences or indirect harm that you might take. But the flip side of all of this is that I think we should also have not a pure negative perspective about all of this, because if we don't find the balance between regulating it properly and over-regulation, that can cause serious problems too, because you might stop a hugely profound technology from going into the market and helping patients and clinicians and the healthcare system in general. And if you don't do that, you sort of shoot yourself in the foot, because yeah, sure, you might shut it down already because you're scared of it. But at the same time, you're not getting any of the benefits. So if we had this type of a perspective on, say, drug development, we wouldn't have all the medicines we have today either. So there is a fine balance to have between regulating it, thinking about it carefully, testing things properly, but also allowing the technology and the companies to flourish and really bring this innovation to patients.
I heard you interviewed another podcast. You're talking about that with AI and just some of the things that you're doing as a company, it allows for people to be utilized better as far as in healthcare and with the shortages that we're seeing in the US, and I'm sure it's elsewhere in the world, that AI can help some of that. As far as do you see that as a big benefit?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, that's exactly what we're working on. So in our case, we're trying to enable non-sort of expert, non-specialized healthcare staff to use ultrasound, for example. That's, and it's not just us, there are other companies doing this as well. And I think that is hugely, I mean, talk about being biased here, you know, if we're going to be frank, obviously it's my company, but I think that's, we've published peer-reviewed papers on this, so I don't think this is controversial to say. I mean, the biggest limiting factor currently in healthcare, the number one issue is staff. They just don't have enough staff to do the amount of work that needs to get done. That's just a fact. And so anything that can support utilizing the existing staff better, and in some sense, almost upskilling them with AI, is hugely valuable. If done properly and safely and tested thoroughly, this can have huge implications. With an aging population that we also have, that's another separate issue. So again, like, these factors compound again and again. So lack of resources, expensive, the costs of healthcare going up, and the reduced number of staff plus an aging population, it basically becomes a disaster. And so the only thing that we can leverage, in all honesty, is technology and AI to be able to solve some of these problems. And I think there are a few companies, including us, that are working on exactly that problem to solve this lack of resources and staff.
That's great. So are there any books that you recommend to other leaders that you have you've read that have had an impact?
Sure. I think someone, I mean, this is such a classic, The Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. Mm-hmm. I've read that book multiple times, and every few years I keep rereading it. And it's so profound because it talks about cognitive biases that we have. I think it was like 4 decades of research, and it really shows you, in my opinion, it's immediately practical. We can use it in practice from a business perspective immediately. So in our company, for example, I'll be like, okay, whenever we run either a study or we make assumptions about the market, I would literally say to my co-founder, you know, maybe we have availability bias, which is one of the biases that's mentioned in that book. And I also see that from the venture capital community, where, do you remember when lots of people were funding crypto stuff, or lots of people were funding, let's see, the quick delivery stuff? That is availability bias all the way, right? And then availability bias goes again when we post on social media and everyone looks successful, everyone's raising money. It makes people feel really bad, again, for the same bias, because you're seeing the successes, not the failures. And the same bias applies in clinical trials, where if you don't take into account the number of, say, false positives or false negatives, of course, in medicine, luckily, this is well thought out anyway. So when you design a study, this is exactly what they would criticize you on if you don't take that into account. But I'm just making my point that, you know, the reason these things are set up so carefully is because of this exact bias. And that's just one out of God knows how many biases I mentioned in that book. So I would definitely recommend people read that book, because it's generally helpful in life and in business.
Good. Any quotes that you refer to often?
Let me think. That's a great question. I'll say one thing my board member told me, you can't save your way to success. So I have this, you know, when you're an early stage startup, especially if you're scrappy and you don't have that much money. I mean, we're Europeans. I'm not sure this advice is very good for an American audience, because they do spend way more money than we do in general. But I will say this for at least some founders, that make sure you're very careful about using money. But when you are spending money, if you've identified like a critical place to spend that money, make sure you go for it. Make sure you don't cut corners. Make sure you actually spend money on, say, the top engineers or the top advisors or the top people, because you will feel like cutting corners and saving a little bit here and there is going to be helpful, it's really not going to be helpful. You know, just even treating your team for a nice dinner or giving them some freedom to purchase things, that has a disproportionate positive impact than whatever financial sort of monetary value of the money is. But obviously, take that with a pinch of salt. That doesn't mean you spend like 50 million on something that's a waste of money, obviously.
Okay. So outside of work, what do you do to recharge?
Oh, you're talking to an entrepreneur whose entire life and identity.
That's all you do, right?
I feel like I'm almost on a date. You know what? That's in a date. Like if I get that question, I'm like, it's so sad because I'm like, I don't know. No, I do like to go to the gym. That is my one place where I need to push weights in order to feel like I'm a human again. But I also, obviously, I really love to read. I think reading is my peaceful space. So I tend to like to read philosophy stuff. So in particular, Greek Stoic philosophy is something I really like. I just enjoy it. I'm not a very passive person, so I can't just passively take information. I have to actively take it. So that's sort of what I do for fun. But otherwise, I'm not that interesting as a person. So I'm not sure I can answer that question in a better way, unfortunately.
No, that's great. Any parting advice you'd give a new leader?
Take yourself seriously. You know, I think we all have a feeling that when we see a problem, that we tend to hope that someone else will fix it. There's always someone else. The reality of the situation is that you're the someone else. So if there's a problem you want to fix, and I'm really talking big problems, I can anything, whether it's stopping nuclear war, climate change, curing cancer. Well, actually, that's probably impossible. But other things, I mean, like whatever it is, whatever big sort of thing you want to do, if you want to get it done, probably there's no one better than you to get it done, because you would be extremely surprised about how little thought or how little effort is put into actual real problems. And the sad part of it is that if you're a humble, not, you know, on a person who's humble and not very arrogant, ironically, you're the right person to solve these problems because you're thoughtful. And if you don't try to solve some of the world's problems, the people who don't have that consideration, who aren't humble, who perhaps care much more about their personal gain, will be the ones that end up stepping up. And you're not doing anyone a service if you allow them to be the ones that actually lead the world. Because at the end of the day, we are one big collective. So we all have to take personal responsibility for the way the world is, because we are literally contributing to it, each and every one of us. So my I suppose advice to a leader is actually be a leader, because if you're not going to be a leader, who else is going to do that job? You know, someone has to. And yeah, probably it's a good idea for it to be you.
Absolutely. Well, this has been, I've enjoyed our conversation, and I wish you continued success in your important work that you're doing as a company, and definitely look forward to seeing kind of your journey as you grow your company and its impact on healthcare.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate it. I hope we can speak again.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.